Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. My guest on this month's General Talk is General Sir James Everard. Commissioned into the 17th 21st Lancers in 1983, he commanded the Queen's Royal Lancers in the year 2000, and later 20th Armour Brigade and 3rd UK Division, before being appointed Commander Land Forces, subsequently the Field Army, in 2014. His 37-year career in the British Army saw operational service in Cyprus, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo and Iraq, before taking up his final post in Belgium as Britain's senior military representative to NATO, the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander, Europe, in March 2017. Closer to home, in April 2020, General Everard took over from General Sir Mike Jackson as the new president of the Soldiers' Charity. Our wide-ranging conversation began with a discussion on retirement, which seemed to have crept up all too quickly on the General, who left the Army in September last year.
I think it's come, it's come very quickly. And of course, leaving a NATO environment where many of your opposite numbers, generals, are in their mid-60s, yeah. They look at you slightly as, as a youngster. They can't believe you're off. But actually, I'm a great believer that everything has a natural pattern to it. And also, bringing young blood through is important. And so it's probably the right time to push off and go and do something else.
Do you think Tim Radford sees himself as young blood?
I think Tim Radford, again, because he's working in a NATO environment, he will be young in comparison to many of his peers, and yet, in terms of his authority, superior to them.
How did you find it, working outside the British Army as NATO's senior British officer and as D-Secur? I mean, it's a different environment from the British Army, isn't it?
It's a massively different environment from it. But it is, I tell you, it's the greatest fun, if you can say that. I mean, I don't know when you've last been to the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, but you've got, of course, the 30 allies there represented, all of them having a national day at some stage or another, which you're required to turn up to, which is good. Along with, I think, when I left, 27 partner nations are represented there. And so the whole idea of sort of multinational harmony is born in the relationships between you and your families, everybody else. And, you know, the German beer night, they fill their Schützenfest test, I think, for three nights on the trot with 6,000 people a go. I mean, you know, this is, it's not small beer. It's you know, massively good fun. But also it's a work hard, play hard thing, because I think, you know, their core purpose, collective defence, is of course now very much back as a primary driver for the alliance, given the Russian annexation of the Crimea. And so you do have, I think, that sense of purpose that perhaps was lost a bit after the end of the Cold War. So it's good.
Beer nights aside, do you think that NATO is still a credible force?
I think it is. I mean, with Donald Trump, of course, you always had to look at what the Americans were doing as opposed to what he was tweeting, and the American commitment to NATO was just as strong throughout his tenure as it ever has been, you know, and they are the predominant force in NATO. Actually, the treaty was designed with them to be the predominant force in NATO, and I do have a sympathy with people like Macron who think Europe needs to do more, but the gap between what the Europeans have and what the Americans bring to the party is so huge.
Let's talk about that gap. Do you think it is a given that D-Secur will always be a British post from now on?
Yes, I do. And people get confused by the various strands of D-Secur's portfolio. And so, you know, D-Secur is primarily responsible to SACUR for the delivery of forces for NATO missions, operations, activities, all slightly different, what we would call force generation. That's his primary driver. But he's also the NATO-EU strategic coordinator. I mean, if the EU did an operation tomorrow, they have a planning staff at SHAPE. You know, they're all double-hatted NATO, EU. Actually, the EU have never called on them to make use of that, but that role still exists. Mm-hmm. That will stay with the UK DSACR as now. But when I took over, DSACR under the Berlin Plus arrangements was also the operation commander for the EU Operation Althea in Bosnia, which I did for just over 2 years. And then that stopped. You know, that has gone to the French vice cos, because I think not unreasonably, a number of European partners did not believe it was appropriate that a Brit commanded what is such a high profile EU operation. So that has already gone. Everything else I think will stay as it is. Primarily, Harry, because unpicking the NATO flags to post equation is such a nightmare, a Pandora's box that no one wants to go there. And I think if people like SACA had one concern, it would be our ability to operate at the speed of relevance. You know, the decision-making process that goes up from SHAPE to the North Atlantic Council, you know, 30 people all referring back to their capital to make sure that they're happy with what's been said. It's not electric, let's put it that way.
So arguably, it may never happen.
What, war might never happen, or...
Well, no, NATO acting as a single force might never happen.
Well, of course, NATO's busy already. You know, I mean, it's amazing how little you see of Afghanistan in the UK newspapers today. Yeah. But that's still, you know, NATO's biggest operation. You know, thousands of troops there. Iraq still ticking on, you know, all the standing maritime activity going on. I mean, they're not busy. And if you were to see a slide which showed you how much activity is going on, even on the eastern flank of NATO, I mean, it's pretty impressive. I think we put nearly 250,000 troops exercising somewhere on our eastern flank last year in some shape or form. And again, they're working to a NATO common purpose. So, you know, it does work.
As reporting Director General Todd D. Walters of the United States Air Force, did you find that you were advising him a great deal about actual how the mechanics of troops on the ground actually work?
Todd Walters, he doesn't need any education. I mean, that's one of the things you really learn. Arriving as DSACR, working for then Curtis Gapparotti, American paratrooper, and then Todd Walters, American airman, who had actually come out of being the NATO air component commander, so he had a lot of NATO experience, is that if you get to be a four-star in the American firmament, you are pretty good at what you do. And also, they are still taught to think at a scale that I think all the European armies, including ourselves, have simply forgotten how to do. I mean, you know, if I wanted to find the sort of millions of dollars that SACR spends quite easily, I would probably be, I don't know, it would take me months in Whitehall, whereas he can just do it, it's done. So no, I mean, you learn more than they learn from you. And I think it's a great privilege. And you can't really be his deputy for half his job, because he's also the US, you know, commander of Europe. But you can help him out on the NATO front. And I say it was a really enjoyable thing to do.
You could argue that you are one of a dying breed. That is a cavalry officer who was risen to high command. You joined the army in 1982. You joined the 17th 21st Lancers. You commanded the Queen's Royal Lancers, and your parent regiment is now the Royal Lancers. Do you think we have an armoured corps that is worth calling an armoured corps? What do you think the future of that is?
I think it's just life. You know, actually, if you look at British history, we have a habit, or a big suspicion of standing armies, and we have a habit of disinvesting in combat power when we're not at war. And so you're right, you know, when I joined the army, there we were, three or four decades into preparing for a war that we hoped we would never have to fight. I think we were pretty good at it. You know, was it a wasted endeavour? No, because Common Cause gave deterrence, and I think, you know, led us to victory in the Cold War in the end. And now life is much more complicated. You know, the return of great power competition, but put the muscle mindset of and might of China into the equation, add in this continuing terrorist problem, add in the desire to project stability into these ungoverned and ungovernable parts of the world. You know, it's still a really important role for the armed forces. But I think you're right. I mean, people struggle to see real utility for armoured mass in the days that when you and I were rocking around.
Yeah.
And so they reduce their investment in that and put it elsewhere. And I don't necessarily think that's wrong. I mean, I think emerging and disruptive technologies, cyberspace, all these things are going to be important. I wish you could have both, but I'm not sure you can at the moment.
No, I guess that it's like anything. The moment you start holding on to tradition for the sake of tradition, that's when you're going wrong. When we joined, we had Far East Land Forces, we had Rhine Army, we had UK Land Forces, we had Parachute Brigades, we had Commando Brigades. Do you feel that the army nowadays is a well-rounded operation? Do you think it is happy in its own skin?
I think the real test, of course, is when you go to a British regiment or brigade. Actually, I was with the 3rd Division about a month ago. A, their people are pound for pound better than we were at that age. I mean, they're more professional. They probably smoke less. They run faster. You know, they're better educated. I mean, I think we were good, but of our generation. I mean, they're fantastic young men and women. I mean, really committed. Mm. And they don't feel that sense of loss that you or I might feel looking back, because it's not their life. They just feel that sense of variety, challenge and opportunity, which we felt, but just in a different way. And so I think, you know, all is well in the British Army, you know, firmament. And, you know, who knows, perhaps one has to go through the sort of shock of capture when you go, you know, go to war, you have all those lessons to be learned and you grow again and then off you go.
Well, one thing that struck me is that for an army that is a third of the size when we first joined, there does seem to be an awful lot of generals and an awful lot of WO1s. Do you think we're slightly over-generaled and over-commanded?
I don't think we're over-commanded because, I mean, you know, we understand rank, and so, you know, you might be working in Abbey Wood and not commanding any troops, but the fact you're a general, people understand where you fit in the military jigsaw. If you actually look at our fighting triangle, the number of generals we have in the fighting part of the British Army, I think it's very, very small. And so again, I don't think you want to mix apples and pears. Plus the fact, as you know, if you're administering, I don't know, 1,000 people or 40,000 people, often the footprint you need to do it's the same.
Going back to the peacetime army today, the volte-face from, shall we say, the homophobic, racist days of when we were in first, in 40 years ago, is remarkable. You were patron of the LGBT plus forum. Do you think that we have overplayed or are overplaying the welfare card a bit?
No, but I can't remember what else. It might have been about 2010 when the army had another kicking on its so-called sort of appalling diversity standards and stuff like that. Actually, I never thought it was as bad as that. And Peter Wall saying to me as assistant chief of the general staff, look, we need someone to get a grip of this. And I said, well, I'll do it, because interesting enough, you know, you talk about the sort of army we joined. Joining the 71st Lancers, I don't remember any of that. You know, it was a regiment where you were purely judged on your commitment to the greater good. And I don't think I just don't remember any of those attitudes there. So it was very easy for me to take that and build a sense of sort of progress on our LGBT diversity rights. And I really enjoyed it, actually. When I learned quite a lot, and I made a lot of, you know, took a lot of care to select my successor, Patrick Sanders, another, you know, now 4-star, you know, he's probably handed on himself now, but again, it's a demonstration of intent, isn't it? If you have people that are going places looking after these things, as opposed to it being parked with the lowest tier and the lowest staff level. I don't think we do overplay it, because every time you take your eye off the ball, you get bitten by it. And so perhaps it's just something we've all got to learn to live with until it's so instinctive it can evaporate.
Do you think that while the serving soldier is well supported on the ground in terms of his own training, that actually in terms of budget to do the job and political willpower to see the job through, he's failed by government?
I don't think he's failed by government. I think all governments are disappointed to discover that, you know, achieving complicated objectives on operations like this is just appallingly difficult, and that the military are often just a small part of the, you know, the end state. Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, they're all political nightmares. And so, you know, if people thought this was going to be a quick victory, they were wrong. I remember David Richards saying well back when he was Commander Ark that this is a multi-generational challenge and having lots of people throw empty beer cans at him. But it was absolutely true. So it's not easy, and people have to understand that. I think your political will one is important, because the boots on the ground issue still remains, I think, a big problem. You know, our politicians, I think, probably suffering from Wootton Bassett and everything else, don't like the idea of soldiers dying, and no one does that. But if you're not prepared to take risk, you don't get reward. And actually, young men and women join the British Army to do good things. And you can't do that sitting in a compound. You have to be out and about amongst the people. And that's our Achilles heel at the moment. You can see this, you know, let's send troops somewhere, let's keep them safe.
You leave the army at the age of 58, punishingly young.
Punishingly young, yeah.
You now take on the presidency of ABF from General Sir Mike Jackson. What do you think the challenges of this great new role are?
So I think the biggest sadness for me so far is having taken over the presidency of the ABF, actually because of the, you know, the nightmare of social distancing and everything else, is that I haven't really got to meet the whole cohort of people that we're working with. You know, but A, I'm very honoured to be invited by Mike Jackson, but B, also, when you look into what people think about the Soldiers' Charity ABF, you know, you find time and time again that this is a charity that is, you know, the most trusted, it's the most well-governed. And these are all things that I think are hugely important, because it's not always the case in our charity sector. We have to be honest about it. And so for me, it's the charity with the strongest foundations. It's probably got the longest legs. And I'll be really keen to see where we can take it.
One of the great issues today is that of mental health. Beyond the serving army, there is a huge army of veterans, larger than, three times larger than any serving standing army we have today. And within that, a lot of mental welfare cases and so on. How do you think that we can best meet these challenges today?
It's going to be a growing challenge. When you come back to the serving army, the transformation has been that people no longer feel embarrassed, concerned, worried about admitting the fact that they feel under pressure. As in Sweden, about 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, one of their biggest concerns amongst their officer corps is it's not a natural thing for a Nordic man to talk about his pressures or problems and stuff like this. And so they've got a growing mental health problem. And these are people not at combat. These are people just working hard at their desks. So it's not just us. It's a problem that's affecting all nations. And at least I think we're ahead of most of them in terms of our thinking. But in the end, it comes down to A, people being honest, and B, the resources to treat them. And I don't think we're probably in exactly the right space in either of those two equations.
One of the interesting things I always think that contributes to these sorts of problems is social media. I note that you are not on Twitter. You must be one of very few senior officers in the army and warrant officers who doesn't participate on Twitter. What drove you to that very sensible decision?
Interesting enough, I'm not on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, any of those things, although people keep on creating accounts in my name that some poor soul has to go and take down, because they always make me sound a bit of a dick, if I have to say. They make me sound wise, it wouldn't matter. So I'm not on any of these things. Why? Because I think what you think is well-meaning and well-intentioned is often always misconstrued by someone to cause mischief. And actually, if you are commander of field army, you can radiate your views out through the field army mechanisms without having your own. I mean, I have American bosses who have people that all they do is social media. That's their job. I mean, they're tweeting and twittering and doing stuff all the day.
That would drive me to mental health problems today.
Yeah, well, it's a dark old world out there.
So here we are, president of the ABF, retired general. I can't see that you're going to be growing roses for the rest of your life. What's next?
Well, I've already started, really. I mean, I formally took over yesterday after a sort of 6 month learning period, which we didn't do much of because of COVID, the role of the lead senior mentor for Allied Command Operations, in other words, SHAPE in NATO. That's running a pool of sort of 14 to 17 admirals, generals who go and help NATO commanders unpick some of the problems that they are facing. I'm also doing the mentoring for three UK divisions. They take their place up with a US warfighting corps. That's a separate project, which I'm really keen to do because I think getting three div as good as it can be is really important. And I very much like the current GOC, used to be my chief of staff. I think it's a real talent, so that's good. And it won't surprise you that I've got my fingers in a number of other small things. And so there's always that advice. Someone says, you don't do anything for your first year, take your time and then decide. I thought, bollocks to that. I'm going to accept everything that looks vaguely interesting. And then if I can't do it, then I'll shed it over years.
We are looking ahead now to the new year, to 2021, and hopefully a coronavirus-free year by the end of it. What is your message, if you had one, for ABF and its supporters?
You know, what is so impressive is during a pandemic, it would be very easy for people to become wholly inward-looking and concerned for self as opposed to others. And yet you see writ large across the sort of support base of ABF that people haven't done that. They've been as interested, as worried, as concerned, you know, about ABF. And I think that speaks volumes, and it tells me that in terms of a foundation, you know, we're rock solid. And it will be getting back up to full momentum as quickly as we can in the new year. Although I happen to believe that it'll drag on longer than we want it to.
I think 2021, we can both agree that there is a candle in the window at least. General Sir James Everard, thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk today. And as the new president of ABF, the soldier charity, I wish you all good luck in your new post.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the soldier charity or take part in its many events, please visit soldierscharity.org. With editing by Michael Stiliano, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the soldier charity.